Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're here giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We're rebroadcast on a2zen.fm. There is a link to all of this at richarddugan.com. And we enjoy coming your way every single Saturday whenever we come your way. Now, if you listened at all to the promo that I played here on this station, I made reference to looking in the mirror and finding your song. And though I could probably have picked a number of other songs, this one, the chorus line anyway, I would put under the category of my song.
I wanna live, I wanna grow, I wanna see, I wanna know, I wanna share what I can give, I wanna be, I wanna live, I wanna grow, I wanna see, I wanna know, I wanna share what I can give, I wanna be, I wanna live.
And that is the music of the late John Denver, one of my favorite artists. I have probably all of his albums going back to 1969, 1970. That particular song, I remember when it came out, I bought the CD. I think actually, I still have the album. But that song actually put a lump in my throat and brought tears to my eyes, I think, the first time I heard it. That is one of my songs. There are several others, and that's the only one I'm going to play for you here. But I encourage you to take a look at that, because that's what we're going to take a look at today. Not just what is your song, but what brings you happiness and bliss? Well, today we're going to talk with our guest, who is a woman we've had on twice before. The first time we chatted away and we were talking about some wonderful things that she was involved in. And at the end of that interview, I asked her about a book that might be coming out sometime in the near future. She had not shared anything with me about it at that time. Said, why, by the way, I'm actually working on one. And now that you've mentioned it, I guess I'll have to work on it. So we did a second interview. And she hadn't finished it yet. Well, Edie Weinstein, you finished the book. It has been out for a while, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been out since September, and it really felt like giving birth. The book is called The Bliss Mistress Guide, Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And it's what I call chicken soup for the soul kind of book, where there are slice of life stories. So your question was a catalyst and sort of kicked my butt into finishing the book. So thank you.
Well, well, you're welcome. I hope it wasn't overly painful, and if it was, I hope they gave you an epidural.
Nah, wasn't painful. Although I did have the equivalent of what would be like morning. Seriously, once the book was in the hands of the publisher, I would wake up every morning feeling queasy, and it felt like what I imagined that would be like.
Interesting.
The other person that gave me a loving kick in the tush was a friend named Jim Donovan, who's a published author several times over, and he said, this book is not doing anybody any good in your head. Get it out there. Mm. So, yeah, thank you both for that. And I had a lot of midwives helping me with the book, too, so I feel very blessed.
Well, I have to say thank you so much for that. I have to say that it was actually kind of funny in a way, because when we did our second interview and you said you hadn't quite finished it at that particular point, actually I felt kind of bad because, like, oh, man, I put this bee in her bonnet and now she's – but I'm glad you've reached that point now where now you're sharing this whole aspect. First of all, let's define some terms. What do you mean by bliss?
Wow. Bliss is a lot of different things. It means different things to different people. For me, bliss is a connection with life, the universe, and everything, being fully aware in the present moment with whatever's going on. For some people, it could be jumping up and down on a pogo stick, real excited. For some people, it's still and silent, very peaceful, a sense of being at the right place at the right time is how I would look at it.
Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. I felt like I've been in the right place at the right time most of my life with the various events that have happened. So when you talk about the bliss mistress, I mean, the word mistress alone conjures up all kinds of,
yeah.
Well, maybe only one kind of thing. But anyway, so tell me what you mean by the bliss mistress.
Okay. Well, where that name came from, a number of years I started teaching a workshop called BYOB, Be Your Own Bliss, and it was based on the Joseph Campbell concept of following your bliss. And he focused on the idea that when you follow your bliss, doors will open for you that wouldn't open for anybody else. That's paraphrasing him. And I thought, yeah, that's a pretty neat concept, but it still means that you're following something outside of you. And the idea of being your own bliss means that it's not based on what anybody else says or does. It's not based on circumstances. It's based on present moment awareness, as I mentioned before. So on my way into teaching this workshop, one of the participants said, oh, you're the bliss master. You're going to teach us how to live in bliss. And when I got home, I told my friend Jazz, who, again, I've written about in the book, and he was living in San Francisco at the time, so this was a long-distance conversation. And I could see the twinkle in his eye when he said, oh, no, not bliss master, bliss mistress. And, he said, if you're going to call yourself that, you better be living it. And then when I started writing the book, he said, if you're going to be writing about it, you better be living it. Mm. So I do that to the best of my ability. I kind of suck the juice out of the bottom of the glass with everything that I do. And it's about living juicy, about living a rich, full, juicy life.
Yeah, I've heard that term before. I have to say, you must either have done very well in English, as far as punctuation, tenses, and so forth, or had some help, because I believe, if I'm reading the title correctly, if I were to break this down, it would be the Bliss Mistress's Guide. In other words, the guide belongs to the Bliss Mistress. Mm-hmm. But you don't put an apostrophe S. I hear it time and time again. For example, when you refer to something that belongs to or referencing, say, Jesus, you don't say Jesus's.
Right.
And it's like, I hear that on television, in commercials, all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It never felt like that, it's not, part of the reason for that, I don't know that it was intentional, but it's not just mine. That's the whole thing.
Is right.
A friend of mine who read the book said, you know what this book is about? It's about relationships.
Yeah.
Because I talk about my interactions with people, with experiences. In the book, I have a resource guide in the back with a whole bunch of people in it who do amazing work in the world. And when I first started writing the book, one of the most enjoyable parts was the gratitude section, where I thanked all the people in my life that have made my life so rich and juicy and beautiful. So it's not my guide. It belongs to everybody. And it's not just a book for women.
Right.
Even though probably the demographic is more women. My generation, I'm 53, so I was assuming that most of the readers would be 40, 50 and above, and mostly women, mm-hmm. but I have had men read the book and really get a lot out of it. I've had, women in their 80s, 90s read the book, 20-something-year-olds read the book. So it's got something for everybody in it. So it's everybody's guide. And it's the idea of being the mistress or master of your own bliss.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an outside job. It's inner work.
I also think, too, that there's an aspect of this, too, where you have to be okay with expressing your excitement over that which others see as just an ordinary event. And I have to say that I was paid a very high compliment back in the late 1990s when I was working for a company. And I was just sitting there chatting with this gentleman from Hawaii. He was working in Scottsdale with me at the time. And I was sharing with him some of my experiences, and I had just learned to drive and experiencing my first time going through a drive-through and some of the other things that I had experienced, along with the first time I'd ever experienced going through a divorce and so forth. Well, not as joyous, but nonetheless. And the compliment he paid me was, he says, I love listening to you because you make the ordinary thing sound so exciting and extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to remember that, especially when I get out on the highways here in California on the Central Coast, whether it's here in Santa Barbara or even driving, and I've even driven down in Los Angeles, which when I was 25 and 30, I never dreamed I would be in Los Angeles, let alone driving in Los Angeles. But when I look around me at the other cars, I try to remind myself, my God, you weren't here 20 years ago inside this vehicle, in this seat, doing what you're doing. And you never had any hopes, plans, or dreams of doing that because you kind of gave that. And I did. I had given up the struggle with, at that time, the Arizona DMV to just get a license to operate a moped. I couldn't even do that. So I said, fine, you know what? Pedaling, bicycling everywhere and when I'm 65, it's okay. I can live with that because I'm still getting around. I'm doing great. And I'll be healthier. I think that that's what you're talking about, isn't it? Is taking even those ordinary events, like maybe just, I was watching a flock of birds literally the other day, and they were in a straight line and they were swerving back and forth, but they all followed each other to the letter. They were exactly the same distance apart as far as I could tell. I don't know how they did that, but it was extraordinary to watch them weave through the skies until they disappeared in the clouds. And I thought, wow, how do they do that? We can't even do that with extensive choreography, Edie.
Right. And airplanes are off course, was it like 90% of the time?
Don't say that.
Course correction, I think is what I heard. So you nailed it. I mean, you really said what I find bliss to be, is finding fascination. I'm never bored. I'm always fascinated. And, finding fascination with bugs, finding fascination with watching animals cross the road. There's nothing that bores me in life, and it sounds like it's the same thing for you. And when you're open to that, amazing things show up. Amazing people show up when you open the door to bliss. So I'm glad you're doing that.
I also noticed, too, that there are times when I will, express an observation of something and people will look at me and even make a comment to the extent that, well, we've always known you were a little loony. And I kind of own that, but it has nothing to do with that. It's like, well, wait a minute. The Bible talks about the only way you're going to get to God is if you come to him as a child, childlike.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude, that frame of mind, if you will, which isn't even a frame of mind, it's imagination, it's creativity, that's the left side of the brain, isn't it?
Left is linear. I think of left as linear and logical. The right brain is the creative side.
Thank you. I was looking for the hook. I was looking for that. Okay, so it's the right brain that's doing that, and that's what we're trying to tap into here, because that's where a lot of incredible ideas come from.
Mm-hmm.
Inventions and art and music and dance and so on and so forth.
Yeah, can you imagine not having that connection? For me, music feeds my soul. Writing, art—it's so soul nourishing to be around that. I have most of my friends are creative types. I have a lot of friends that are singer-songwriters, performers, artists, journalists, and I attract that because it's healing for me, and it's also the idea like attracts like. That's what I'm about is endless creativity. I'm speaking to you from my room right now, and it's very colorful and posters on the walls created by Sark. Are you familiar with her?
I've had her on many times.
Yes. I'm looking at the one that says Live Juicy.
Yes.
I have vision boards all over my walls of things that I've created, including something that happened in 2008 that I planted a seed for 20 years earlier. I had the opportunity to interview the Dalai Lama, which is a 20-year journalistic dream. So on two of the vision boards I'm looking at right now, I have pictures of the Dalai Lama that I cut out. I've got, just all kinds of creative things around me. So I surround myself with people, with objects, with ideas that are constantly inspiring, I guess is the right word, inspiring me to create more myself. So if there's anybody that's listening, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are listening that feel this way, that they have a passion and a purpose and they don't know how to feed it. Feed it with that which it's like what you want. Mm-hmm. Surround yourself with people that are creative souls if you see yourself as being creative. I remember a story, and I don't know whether I told this one of the last two times I was on, about David Bowie, that before he was famous, he wanted that so much, and people weren't paying attention to his music. So he started to act as if he was already the famous rock star that he is now. And he was seen with rock stars. He dressed the part. He acted the part. And within a short period of time, he got noticed.
Mm.
So if someone listening is aspiring to be whatever, act now as if you already are that.
Yeah, I know the common phrase is fake it till you make it.
Well, it's not even faking it for me. I mean, you can fake it, but your mind knows when you're faking it. You know, the universe knows when you're faking it. But I think the universe buys it when you live it as if.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm saying this, I got goosebumps, and that's my truth barometer. When I have goosebumps, it's like, yeah, this is good. This is good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little scary sometimes to take that leap, to be able to say, all right, before I started, before the book was actually out, I started calling it my first bestseller. And that's what I refer to it as, my first bestseller. And that means to me that I'm setting an intention that it's going to be a bestseller, and I'm setting an intention that it's not going to be the only one. So language makes such a huge difference. Our minds believe everything we say. The other morning I woke up with this thought, name it and claim it. Now, I don't know if I've ever heard that before. I have to look it up and see if there's anybody else that said it that I was familiar with. But when you hear name it and claim it, what does that say to you?
Whatever it is that I want, if I say it, I will have it.
Yeah, and it's saying it as your own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even necessarily what you want, because there's a flip side to it, too. How often do we find ourselves saying, I'm tired, I've had enough?
Yeah.
Using language that's negative. Because the idea of I am, the idea that God referred to itself with Moses as I am that I am.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we say I am, we're exercising our God language. So if we say, I am a successful author, I am a successful talk show host, I am a healthy, vibrant being, we're naming it and we're claiming it. And if we're saying, I am tired, I am worn out, I am a victim, we're naming it and claiming it. So...
Well, you've actually opened up the door for a question that I usually reserve for the end of the program.
Okay.
So I guess I will bring it forth now, and I'll put it in the current vernacular, as you've stated it. So who am?
Am I?
Who am Edie Weinstein?
A work in progress, because I'm always stretching. I'm always opening to new ideas. I call myself an optimistic, OPTI-MYSTIC, and in my mind, that's somebody that sees the world through the eyes of possibility. And I see that, I'm not a glass half full or glass half empty person. I'm a glass all full to overflowing kind of person.
Mm.
Because literally, even if it's only half, the glass is only half full of liquid, the other full is half of air. The other half is filled with air.
Yeah.
So it's always filled with something.
Right. Exactly.
So I see myself that way. And how I see myself is how I am in the world, how I be in the world is how I see myself. So I'm really fortunate to have people that see me in ways that I don't see myself, because I still have a very active monkey mind critic that I need to deal with from time to time, that tells me I'll never be enough. I'll never have enough. I'll never do enough. And it keeps me on this treadmill. It's actually not even a treadmill. Have you ever done spinning in a gym?
Well, as a kid, I used to spin all the time out in the front yard and the lawn.
Not that kind of spinning, but spinning on a bicycle, spinning. It's like a hardcore bicycle workout. Where
I see.
But spinning around is sort of like that, too. You get dizzy and you fall down. It's fun for a little bit.
Yes.
But spinning in a gym class is like high intensity, high impact bicycling. And they show images on a screen of, landscapes and so on. But you don't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's what it's like for me when I do the shoulda, woulda, couldas, what ifs, and if onlys, it's like a high intensity workout that's exhausting, and I don't get anywhere. So, you know, I'd much prefer, if I'm going to be bicycling, to be out in nature somewhere and enjoying the scenery.
Right. Well, now that is interesting the way you put that, because I know that there are a lot of people who feel like they're doing that 5 to 7 days a week, yep, 365 days a year.
Yep.
That, you know, regardless of what the state of the world is, their world is the same every day. They get up, they go to work, they come home, then they get up the next day, they go to work, they come home. I mean, it's, and I've referred to this as the treadmill.
Yeah, oh, it is. It is. Although, you know, I still get up and go to work every day. I still have a, the word ordinary, when I use the word ordinary, it doesn't mean bland, boring,
mm-hmm,
but I still have a routine life.
Right.
I still get up every day. I still go to my full-time job right now. I still have bills to pay. I still do laundry and cleaning and grocery shopping, and I still have social interactions. So my day can look the same from day to day, but I decide how I feel about these things. Before I get out of bed every morning, I set an intention to have extraordinary experiences and connect with amazing people. And every day I do, whether these are folks I meet live and in person, or people like you that I've connected with via the Internet and we're speaking voice to voice, or people that I just connect with via Facebook, which is a remarkable tool. It's a remarkable networking tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it as a way of letting, you know, tapping into other people's worlds and opening a window into my world. And I've made amazing connections. But I do the work. Everything that I teach in my writing, in my speaking, I teach classes and workshops. I do coaching. Everything I teach, I do. You've heard the saying, we teach what we need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm learning. You know, there's a lot of things that I'm needing to learn.
But does it really work?
Does it work?
No. Is it really work?
It's a labor of love. It does require, I don't want to use the word effort, but it does require focused intention and attention,
mm-hmm,
because it's so easy to get distracted by anything.
What about multitasking versus serial tasking, as we call it around here?
Well, unfortunately, I've learned to become a multitasker.
How is that working for you?
Most of the time it does, but I know, I remember something my very wise mother used to say, is the hurrier I go, the behinder I get.
Mm-hmm.
So I can multitask as long as I take my time and do them. I'm at a stage in my life right now that I have to consciously say, okay, here are my keys. I check my purse, my wallet's in there, my cell phone's in there, here are the objects that have become conveniences and or necessities in my life. And I have to do an inventory to make sure I have them with me, because I've been known to forget. And I don't want to program that as I get older this is an issue, but I'm 53, and when I was 43, I didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm learning how to multitask more efficiently. There have been times when I feel like the guy on the Ed Sullivan show that used to spin the plates.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
I do.
And yeah, I can't keep as many in the air without dropping them. So I need to remind myself to ease back rather than being so high intensity. And believe it or not, even as busy as I am now with the book promotion and, you know, the literal book tour and the virtual book tour, I still have to slow down and take some veg time.
Yeah.
Because so many of us who do whatever work we do burn the candle at both ends till there's no more wax left.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have that luxury.
And no more wick either.
Yeah.
Edie Weinstein is my guest. Her book is The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. We are going to continue talking with her and sharing with you here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Edie Weinstein, author of the Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. I almost did that, didn't I? Put an extra S on there. And, I find it interesting. I happen to watch some of the videos on your site and some other locations as well, and you're speaking in front of groups of people, and you're signing books, and people are coming up and saying hello and thank you so much and so on and so forth. And you inspire a lot of folks to get out there and do something with their lives, to find their purpose, if you will, to make a difference in, if only their own lives, then their own lives, if not the lives of the people around them. Which, on a side note, there are a lot of sayings I'm finding that are now turning out to not be true. For example, one is that you can't change someone else. I am finding that that is a lie. You may not do it consciously, but when you change, it's kind of like sliding tiles. As soon as you slide one way, it opens up the space for somebody else to slide into that position.
Yep.
And you have changed them. So that's one of those things. But I wanted to ask you about these folks that you've met over the years in the work that you've been doing. We want to talk about that as well as continuing to let people know about the Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. Who inspires you?
Everybody, actually, not just the famous people that I've interviewed. And I've had the blessing of interviewing so many of them, everyone from the Dalai Lama to Ram Dass, Ben and Jerry, to Ariel Ford, Debbie Ford, Joan Borisenko, all of the movers and shakers that a lot of your listeners are familiar with. But I'm also inspired by people who are not just survivors of trauma and abuse and tough stuff, but the people that are thrivers that take that and turn it into something positive. Everybody from Alex, from Alex's Lemonade, to people that created Mothers Against Drunk Driving, to all the people that make a difference in the world every day that you don't even hear about. So inspired people inspire me. People that are enthusiastic, that take what they've got and create something beautiful and magical from it. So those are the folks that inspire me. You inspire me. You're doing what you love. You're living your passion. So that's inspiring to me.
Well, I have to say that when I do this program and I have people on such as yourself, and we've had you on a number of times in the past, but still it's like Christmas morning and I'm opening up a new gift every morning. And that's how I have viewed it, and I've opened up thousands of gifts over the 30-plus years.
Yeah.
And so when we go out into the world and we're faced with the various challenges that we are, and some of them are major and some of them are minor, we seem to become so easily distracted. And we end up getting off course, even if it's just mentally and emotionally, and in I suppose you could take it to the spiritual level as well. Case in point, just getting out on the road in your car. You could be getting in your car, you just listen to the most wonderful piece of music, and you have it in your player in your car, and you're in there, and you get out on the road, and the nuts come out of the nut box.
Yeah.
And you just want to throttle somebody, my mother's term, to throttle somebody. I haven't figured out what exactly that means, but nonetheless, her term. And it's like you've just been distracted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you've allowed yourself to be distracted.
Yeah, and there's that course correction again. When the airplane gets off course, you got to bring it back on course. And
how do you do that?
By reminding myself of this moment. I find something to bring my attention back to here and now. I remember Dan Millman saying this, and I love Dan. I've interviewed him, I think, twice, and Way of the Peaceful Warrior is still one of my favorite books. And I remember hearing him speak at an event here in the Philadelphia area several years ago, and he was telling the story of a man that had come up to him after one of his presentations. And the man said to him, "You know, Dan, I'm sure you get a lot of money for a consultation. I only have a dollar. I'm going to give it to you. Can you give me some words of wisdom?" So Dan holds out his hand. Man puts a dollar in it, and he says to the man, "Here and now, breathe and relax." And that's it. I mean, that's all there is to do. So every time I find myself being aggravated, distracted, I do some version of that. All right, come on back. You know, it's sort of like when you have a little child, you don't want to hold on to them tightly, but you also don't want them to run away. So you want to give them some latitude.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you see them wandering too far astray, say, okay, come on back now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what I have to do with my child mind that wants to go off and get distracted either in a positive or a negative way. Okay, time to come back now. You know, right here. Let's focus. And it works.
Mm.
And I have to do it. And my full-time job right now is as a social worker in a psychiatric hospital. So there are a lot of distractions.
I'll bet.
And I get knocked off center a lot. I have to pull myself back.
Have you also gotten caught in the trap? Because honestly, I have. All right, I've pulled myself back, but I feel so disgusted with myself for being allowing myself to be distracted.
Right. Well, again, that's the monkey mind that says there's something wrong with me because I'm not living up to my potential. Anytime I find myself, or I don't even say find, I lose myself in that experience, I remind myself that I would never be as hard on anybody as I am on myself. I have friends who have known me for a lot of years who don't understand that. You know, why are you so hard on yourself? You know, why do you have such outrageously high expectations for how you're supposed to be? I have a dear friend that called me on it, and I've known her since the 1980s. And she had a copy of my book, and she said, "I'm not going to open this book until you get real. I want to see you get angry. I want to see you yell and scream." You know, and I did. She and her husband led me through this exercise a couple months ago, where I did an emotional release session with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I know them. I trust them. They're family. So in their apartment, they put pillows on the floor. They gave me a plastic baseball bat, and I said, "But aren't your neighbors going to complain?" "Oh no, we do this all the time."
Oh, wonderful.
You know, the others are used to it. Our neighbors are used to it. "But aren't I going to scare the dogs? They have these two wonderful dogs, Dodger and Bananas." "Oh, no, they'll be fine. They're used to it." And they sat and they watched me. And I was down on my hands and knees wailing on these pillows and just screaming. You know, and most people that know me would be shocked at, you know, the things that I said. And they, you know, but it was so cathartic. And it felt so good to just get it out there. And then a couple days later, my body rebelled, and I had sacral spine pain where it was hard to walk. So part of it was, you know, the physical release with the baseball bat being on my hands and, you know, being on my knees. But part of it, I think, was the emotional, you know, experience of purging like that.
Yeah.
And when I was done, she says, "Okay, now I can read the book." You passed the test. I can read the book now.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure who paid for the book. You or her?
Right. But it was so healing,
yeah.
And it reminds me that I'm allowed to be fully human. You know, I remember, Alan Cohen, another friend who I've known for like 30 years, and was a teacher of mine initially in 1979 when I first really got into this work. He said something about there are times when he uses words that are not in his spiritual vocabulary. And me too.
No, really?
that I'm not always goody two-shoes.
Yeah.
So that's part of the Bliss Mistress too, is that I'm not always positive. I don't always hold high, holy, lofty thoughts. Nobody does all the time. I'd be worried about them if they said they did.
Do you think Mother Teresa did?
Oh, no.
Dalai Lama?
No, I do. They have those thoughts. No, I know they do. The Dalai Lama even told me that when I interviewed him that he gets angry. And he was telling me that he got angry at this New York Times reporter who asked him this question repeatedly. Because at the end of the interview I did with him, I said, you know, you're 73 at the time. And I said, you know, what legacy do you want to leave when you die? And he says, oh, no, it doesn't matter. The legacy doesn't matter. And he said, it's not in keeping with his Buddhist practice to talk about his legacy, because I'm not supposed to care about it when I'm dead. It's what I do now. And I said, I'm not, asking about that. It's, how do you live in a way that people will learn from? And he says, he was fine with that. But he said, there was a time when a New York Times reporter asked him that question multiple times, and every time he gave her the answer, she kept asking. And he said, if you ask me one more time, I'll lose my temper. He said that to her. And I said, well, I won't ask you again. We're friends, and I want to keep it that way. So he has human emotions. And the Mother Teresa thing, at work a couple years ago, somebody said to me, oh, you're so calm. You're like Mother Teresa. And I said, honey, I am no Mother Teresa. And I bet there are some days when Mother Teresa was no Mother Teresa.
Mm.
Because she ran a business. She was, she wasn't just a nun. She was a businesswoman. And she had people to oversee and to organize. So I'm sure she had a temper.
Yeah.
I'm sure she used words that were not in her spiritual vocabulary. I can't imagine being that zen, and that numb to feeling.
I think that's one of the struggles that we have in our spiritual pursuits, whatever we want to call it, our purpose, our raising our consciousness to a higher level, that we want to separate ourselves from our humanness, which contains a lot of good and a lot of not so good. But that's what makes up the human being.
Oh, yeah.
And I like I said, I do find that interesting. I have to chuckle because when you were talking about this person and saying, I'm no Mother Teresa, it brought back to mind the 2000 campaign debate. I remember, you remember the line that was stated, somebody, it was Dan Quayle who said something in reference to Jack Kennedy, and the Democratic opponent said, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine, and you, sir, are no Jack Kennedy. And I thought, and you are no Mother Teresa. Well,
right.
You know what? Actually, I am, because she got angry. She's got.
Okay, so I can say that. I was like, yeah.
Yeah. I can say I am a Mother Teresa. But
yeah.
I think that's one of the other aspects, too, is that as we progress in our lives, I think about, for example, the example of David Bowie, who wanted to be a rock star before he was a rock star, and he did that. And when we start to, so to speak, ascend to that pedestal of sorts, okay, people put very high expectations on us as unflappable, infallible, even tempered, if you will, always there for someone, depending upon what the work is that you're doing, and they don't expect you to have a, we'll call it a cathartic moment. I think about this, there's this movie that, this documentary that I watched about this young man who is trying to have captured and arrested this Ugandan head of a militia down there, Kony is his last name.
Right. Yeah.
And the filmmaker, basically, he had a little bit of a breakdown because of the success of what was happening. And it's like, if the person's never experienced these kinds of things and doesn't have the necessary adjustment faculties, what do you expect? If you try to take your car up a 45-degree angle for 20 miles, what do you think's going to happen?
It may not make it.
It may not make it.
And if it doesn't have the proper lubrication and the proper maintenance, I do understand. It's funny that you say that about being unflappable. I think people see me that way, as being unflappable, or as being a constant presence and reliable, which is great. I love being the go-to person, and at the same time, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, I learned from masters. Both of my parents are in spirit now, but they were such reliable people. They were such rocks that everybody counted on. They were lifelong volunteers. They could always be counted on to do the right thing. And I inherited that from them. And it's a big responsibility, and there's sometimes when I don't want it, you know, where I say, all right, I'm doing what I can, but none of us can be all things to all people. And it is a gradual process. I remember telling somebody a few years ago that if I ever become really famous, to, you know, keep me humble, and they said, oh, no, no, you don't need us to do that. You've got your son for that. So my son just turned 25 yesterday, and when he was 14, he says, Mom, I'm an undercover angel sent to teach you patience.
Oh, my.
And he's still teaching, and I'm still learning. I've raised him solo since my husband died when Adam was 11. This was in 1998. And we've grown up together. We've learned a lot from each other, and we've helped each other heal. Mm. My son and I have helped each other heal a lot. And he calls me on my stuff all the time. You know, Mom, you tell people they should do X, Y, and Z. You're not doing it. You need to do it. So, you know, that's what he's there for.
Yeah, and I think that's
another...
Well, and that's another aspect of it, too, is that we all say so much. And I will say that my humility and attempts at staying humble come most of the time in the past. They came from a place where when I began to have the glimmer of thinking too highly of myself. Now, there is an okay space where it's okay to say, hey, I'm good at this. I love doing it, and I'm good at it. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. But when you start to take that on and you become bigger than life, and you know, as the phrase goes, a legend in your own mind,
yes.
The universe has a way of bringing around those humbling experiences to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It doesn't take much. I'll be honest with you. Because of my upbringing in school and so forth, it doesn't take much to get me back on track. So I really try to keep a low profile when it comes to those kinds of things. But I know that as we move forward in life, you know, we're constantly meeting all kinds of new people, and we're gathering not only experiences but new information, new knowledge, and hopefully in some cases new wisdom. But we learn so much, it's hard to remember everything we said. So it's kind of nice that your son is there to say, excuse me, but you taught in lesson 162 that.
Right.
So live it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's mostly about self-care and self-compassion. It's mostly about taking time for myself is what he reminds me about. And that's nice to have that. And, you know, I'm exceptionally conscious of not wanting to be full of myself, to the point that it's, there's a fine line between tooting your own horn and being shamelessly self-promoting and being obsessed with my being the center of the universe.
Right.
And the other part of it saying, oh, no, no, not me. I can't accept that gift, that praise,
yeah,
whatever. I had these interesting experiences. I was at a conference, an event on Saturday. And this has happened a couple of times where I walk into the bathroom and somebody recognizes me before I get into the stall. They'll say, oh, you're Edie Williams. No, we know you from Facebook, or we know you from when you published Visions Magazine. So I meet people in the bathroom a lot. And I said, oh, you recognize me. And then I meet people. I was talking about meeting people in the bathroom, that they recognize me there. And I feel so blessed that I have the opportunity to connect with people through the work that I do.
Absolutely. And they can still connect with you through your website. What is the website that you're using these days?
Okay, it's liveinjoy.org. I also write for a wonderful website called BeliefNet, which is an interfaith website. And I have something called the Bliss Blog, which is a long email, so I'm trying to think how to do
is
that.
It linked, is it linked to liveinjoy.org? Is there a way for them to get there?
On there, but it just, you can look up Bliss Blog, BeliefNet, but it's just features.beliefnet.com/blissblog.
Okay.
That's probably the easiest easiest way to get to it.
All right. And we encourage you to do so, to get in touch with Edie Weinstein, and of course, pick up her book, The Bliss Mistress: A Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. We encourage you to check all that out. It's great information. As we continue here on the program, I wanted to also touch upon the beginnings of all of this. Now, when we first, the very first time that we talked, I was intrigued by an organization that you were involved in that was similar to something that I had experienced in Phoenix. It was dissimilar, but similar. And it was, you were involved in what were referred to as cuddle parties,
yes,
which were non-sexual, they were intimate in the context that they brought people together to experience a certain level of closeness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I still do them. Cuddle Party is a workshop, a 3.5-hour workshop created by two relationship coaches named Reed Mihalko and Marcia Baczynski. They were in New York at the time. They're both out in California now. In the San Francisco, he's in Oakland, I believe, and she's in San Francisco. And it was created as a workshop to help people with intimacy. Now, we're not just talking about sexual intimacy. It's about communication, boundary setting, asking for what you want in life, not just about touch, saying yes to what you want, no to what you don't want. And it's in a safe setting. Now, the cuddling part gets the lion's share of the attention because it's edgy for some people. It's for adults, and you come to it dressed in your PJs or yoga clothes or sweats, just comfy clothes. And the first 40 minutes is what's called the welcome circle, where the safe container is created, and people talk about, we talk about the rules of cuddling. We talk about what people's experience has been around touch, what kind of touch they like, what they don't like. Most of us, I've been very fortunate to be the exception to this rule, but most people either grew up in homes where touch was limited, non-existent, abusive, or sexual. And a lot of us live and work in low-touch environments. I was very blessed to grow up in a very emotionally and physically nurturing family. Most of my friends are really touchy-feely kind of people. Even at my hospital job, with my coworkers, we hug each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about Cuddle Party is that touch is always optional, and it's always within verbal consent. Even if you go there with your spouse, your partner, your best buddy, your parent, whoever, you have to ask permission and get a verbal yes before you touch that person. So after the first 40 minutes, then we do what we call freestyle cuddling, which is spooning, snuggling, massaging, nuzzling, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just lovely for, you know, for someone like me who's a you know, just thrives on touch. For people who are unaccustomed to it, it's a revelation. They float out of there for the most part. We've had people come to cuddle parties, and they're all over the world now. And there is a certification training for it that they're still doing. But there are people that have had very painful experiences around touch who come out of there having felt a sense of opening and awakening and healing. Now, it's not therapy, but it does have therapeutic value.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want to learn more about it, it's just cuddleparty.com. is the workshop. I'm going to be doing two of them in June with another amazing cuddle party facilitator. Her name is Monique Darling, and we've never met, but that's her real last name is Darling, and she really is absolutely darling. but she's coming to New Jersey, and we're going to be doing one together June 9th and 10th, I believe, in South Jersey. So if people want to learn about it, they can go to the website, cuddleparty.com.
I think it's extraordinary that in this day and age, and quite honestly, I was thinking about this over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, how things have changed, attitudes and so forth have changed, not in terms of, you know, permissiveness per se, but just in terms of a willingness to experience. And in some circles, that willingness has actually diminished, but in other circles, it's actually expanded. It almost seems to be some level of balancing. Okay, they went down 10%, this area went up 10%. They went down another 10, up 10. They went down 20, up 20. And it seems like it kind of goes in cycles like that, that we're, and hopefully they stay open in that respect. Do you find Do you have people who share how, gee, you know, I started going to these, and again, they've been going on for, what, 5, 10 years or longer?
I'm trying to think how long, maybe six or seven years.
Okay.
I became certified, I'm thinking, in 2005 or 2006, and they've been going at it for like a year or so at that point.
Okay.
Oh, but, you know how I can remember this? It was 2005 is when I took the training, September of 2005, and I got certified in January of 2006, I believe. So
okay.
For me, it's been a little more than 6 years. So it's been, they've gone out like 7 or 8 years.
And people who may have started at the very beginning, because again, this is kind of goes back to what we started talking about at the beginning of the program about becoming distracted. They get distracted and pulled away from that wonderful experience, and then, of course, they discover it over again, and they come back, and they say, I really missed this and needed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people do come back again and again. There have been people that have come to my cuddle parties 10 times, and it's not because they're needy, loser kind of people. It's because it nourishes them. And these are people, some of whom are in relationship, who are with partners that are not necessarily touchy-feely people. And we encourage people to let their partners know that they're coming to this. And again, there's nothing illicit about it. There's nothing sexual about it. PJs stay on the whole time. No intent, no touch with the intent to arouse. Nothing like that at all. And their relationships have improved. There was one man who used to come to my cuddle parties who stopped coming for about a year, had developed a relationship, and got married, and they now have a child. And he credited cuddle party with preparing him to be able to be in a relationship.
Wow.
And it was so remarkable for him that he invited me to, and I'm an interfaith minister as well. I didn't officiate at the wedding. They had their own officiant, but he invited me to say a blessing at the wedding.
Wow.
Because he said, if not for you and cuddle party, I wouldn't have, this day wouldn't be happening. So it's an amazing opportunity for people to stretch and grow.
And you know, if we looked at it from this perspective, our society is so dysfunctional when it comes to relationships and knowing how they're supposed to work in a healthy fashion and the ways that they don't work. And we see all the wonderful don't work examples on television, on the reality programs. It's wonderful to consider this concept of the cuddle parties as a form of sort of relationship training.
Oh, yeah.
It's only a part of it, but still, it's a very significant part.
Mm-hmm. And it is for me, too. Every time I teach a workshop, whether it's a cuddle party workshop or any of the number of the ones that I teach, I'm learning, too. Mm. And I tell people all the time, the workshop isn't starting right now as we're all sitting together. The workshop started the minute you signed up for it.
Uh-huh.
And for me, the workshop started the minute I decided I was going to teach it. And I'm always learning.
Very cool.
For me, it's a constant workshop. Yeah.
Cuddleparty.com is the website, and you can go to the .org website is liveenjoy.org. The book is the Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. One quick question. We have about a minute.
Okay.
What do you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
Opening hearts and minds and helping people recognize their beauty, their bliss, the love that they are, and help them become a greater force for good in the world.
Wow.
Pretty much it. not too much to ask for, right?
Not bad. Well, you know,
that'll
go on Santa's list.
That'd be good.
Well, wonderful. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your story with us here on the program and look forward to having you back on when your second bestseller is published. And this is not a statement of, okay, the pressure is now on. I have made the statement that you are now so supposed to write your second book. I'm not saying that.
No. I mean, I have several of them already percolating in my head. I just need to have the time to do it all.
There you go.
But thank you so much, Richard. I so appreciate this.
Edie Weinstein is my guest. Again, the book is called The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And if you consider yourself ordinary, well, then start thinking of yourself in more extraordinary, extraordinary ways, if you want to break the word down in that context. And we encourage you to check out
Life Within Joy.
Life Within Joy. cuddleparty.org. You can also check out cuddleparty.com, and you can get in touch with Edie through either of those websites. And we encourage you to stay in touch with us. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Until next Saturday at this same time, love to Lal.